By a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe and Bevere Cafe 2 on the U of I campus. The new Bevere Cafe 2 offers gourmet sandwiches, salads, and ice cream with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the new Institute for Genomics Biology next to Morrow Plots just off the quad on the U of I campus.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Rose, Izzy, and Emma are border collies. Pearl and Clementine are yellow labs. Mother is a barn cat. There are steers named Elvis and Harold, a cow, Luna, a quartet of donkeys. There are chickens, a flock of sheep, and a couple of humans, one of whom is writer John Katz. These are the denizens of Bedlam Farm, a 110-acre farm in upstate New York. In this portion of the program, we'll talk with John Katz about life on Bedlam Farm. It's the subject of his new book, Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, John Katz. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm is John Katz's 16th book. He writes fiction and nonfiction. His nonfiction books include A Good Dog, Cats on Dogs, and The New Work of Dogs. He writes about dogs in rural life for the online magazine Slate. He's written for many other publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, and the AKC Gazette. You can visit John and the farm online at www.bedlamfarm.com. His new book, Dog Days, is published by Villard Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. John, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. I've been thinking about it all year. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's so nice to talk with you again.
We had a great time.
Yeah. Well, what's happening on the farm today?
Well, it's obviously there's a tractor across the street, and the carriage barn is about to collapse into the meadow, so we're shoring that up. The goats got stuck in their hutch last night, so we had to pre them. And we have goats, by the way, new goats.
New goats, great.
New goats. And Rose, as usual, is in command. I pretend to give her instructions, and things are running.
Yeah.
I have a steer, too, Elvis,
yeah.
2,500 pounds.
Wow.
Probably enough for one shot.
Yeah. So it sounds like it can be bedlam.
It is bedlam, but it's under control. You know, I took me a couple of years to figure out how to run the place and how to get help and figure out the seasons. And I love the rhythms of the farm. There's definitely bedlam. I mean, every time you go out, something surprising happens and that's something you're not prepared for. At the same time, you know, when you get used to it, and it takes 3 or 4 years to get used to it, running it is kind of a pleasure. It's all a sort of cacophonous symphony, and it comes together well. I always like to think of the seasons here as being one jump ahead. Right now, we're busy scrambling around getting ready for winter, worrying about hay and water and all those winter things, because if you don't do them now, it'll be too late.
Yeah, and the winters can be pretty serious business out there.
Yes, that was definitely my wake-up call the first winter. I don't want to go through that again.
Yeah. So how are the dog days treating you?
The dog days are great. You know, I'm on a great book tour about this book, and, you know, I often say, I don't really know what a book is about until people read it and tell me. And it's, of course, never about what I think it's about. And this book seems to be about the idea that even at midpoint in life, you can have dreams and you can pursue them and you can achieve them. And that you don't necessarily have to be downsizing or scaling back or preparing for the great long march. If you want to go up on a farm and write about and live with animals, you can do it.
What led you to that decision to dive in and buy this farm?
Well, I started writing about dogs, and that seemed to me that I had found my genre. People were enthusiastic about it. I was touching nerves I hadn't really touched in my writing before. I kind of wandered a little bit blindly into the middle of this companion animal explosion that's engulfing the United States, where people are getting more cats and dogs than ever and loving them more than ever, and other pets. And I started writing about it. I write about what I call the emotional geography between people and their pets, which wasn't being much explored. And that was exciting for me. I mean, it led me to explore sheep herding with border collies, which led me to sheep, which led me to a farm, which led me to buy a farm, which caused me to get, you know, have 110 acres. And then people started bringing me things. I ended up with four donkeys. Somebody couldn't send a steer to market, so I got him, Elvis, and two others. And I had the chance to observe animals in their natural way and on a farm way and get to know them. And that's great. That's been great for my writing, and it's been great for me. It's done me a lot of good. I think the biggest thing it's given me is what I call the gift of compassion, which is the opportunity to treat them responsibly and humanely and sensibly.
Yeah. That makes me think about a certain individual that helped you out on the farm there. I mentioned the animals in my introduction, and I pretty much gave a short shrift to the people of the farm, the people that you rely on. Nobody, you say, can run a farm alone. And here maybe you talk with us a little bit about your farm manager, Annie DeLeo.
Annie, the Bedlam Farm Goddess, as she chose it to be called. I just put a picture up on my website of her and Emma exchanging kisses. Annie is all about loving animals. She loves all animals. I'm not as universally loving as she is, but she does love all animals, and they respond to that in the most touching and loving ways. She's always showing up with wounded birds and rabbits that have been injured, and she fixes them up and saves their lives and gets them on their way. And she also helps me out here. You know, she helps me haul stuff around and tend to the grounds and fix fences and do this sort of myriad, you know, staggering amount of farm chores that you never, never, never come close to catching up with, but are just always pursuing. And she's quite great. You know, she's an incredibly sunny, friendly, warm, cheerful personality. And her love of animals is great. We have very different philosophies, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we battle all the time, good-naturedly, but intensely sometimes, about our different views of animals and the way in which they should be cared for. Annie belongs to this sort of, I think, growing political sensibility that believes all animals should be kept alive really forever by any means at all costs. And she works at that, and to her, a bird out of a nest is just as important as a dog. And it's a beautiful thing. I admire it. It's not my view. I think living on a farm has challenged a lot of my notions about animals, and you can't really run a farm or afford to run a farm or exist on a farm if you don't make choices about animals. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I have a bit of a cold. You can't treat all animals equally. You can't afford to treat them equally. You can't treat them equally emotionally. And I don't even think it's right, in many ways, to take animals out of their natural fate and intervene so dramatically. So these are respectful differences. You know, we work it out very well, and we are very fond of each other and work very well together, but I really couldn't be here without her and value her very much.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the compromise the two of you worked out about the sheep.
Well, we had a number of issues about the sheep, and one of them was that Annie likes to give all the animals here treats. And, you know, it's interesting. She gives the sheep peanuts, and she gives the goats, of course, grains, and she gives everybody something. And it's an interesting issue because farm animals or dogs, any animal, of course, food is life for them. When you give them food regularly, they get excited, and they, of course, start to see people as sources of food. And I like my farm life is different in the sense of what I want. I like the animals to be very affectionate, very socialized, very well cared for, but I don't want them to be all over me or other people. I want them to sort of say hello, take a cookie, and get about their business, which is grazing. And so it's a different approach. We had this issue about whether the sheep need peanuts. She would show up with her pockets stuffed with peanuts. Sheep would get very excited. They come running, and they started looking at other people that way. Pretty soon, they started challenging Rose because they were running past her to get to people they thought had peanuts. And Rose was dealing with this, but it was just, you know, stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue was, really, you know, do sheep need peanuts? And you know, I don't think they do. And so she gives it to them once in a while as a compromise, every couple of months. But by and large, they don't really expect it. Every time somebody comes by, there isn't the stampede and the rush to the gate and all that. So it's one of the many areas. We've had disagreements about whether sick lambs should be kept alive and for how long and at what cost, and whether every ailment of any kind needs to be urgently treated by the vet and medications. And it's interesting. It's a very healthy tension, I think, because I think we need each other and we need the other point of view. But there are so many different ways of looking at this. My own ideas about animal ethics and abuse have changed quite a bit since coming to the farm. I don't have the same point of view I did 3 years ago.
Yeah. One of the things about Annie is her ability to communicate with the animals. You say the animals just turn themselves over to her.
Yep.
What is it that allows some people to have that gift? And what kinds of things have you learned in that regard from her?
Well, again, two things I think I see. One, of course, when you bring animals treats all the time, they're going to like you. And they're going to get excited when they see you and they're going to trust you. I mean, they do. You know, it sounds basic, but it's true. I mean, you know, if you more, I go out with cookies in my pocket for the donkeys, and they just come running. And beyond that, I think Annie has a true gift of empathy. I think her affection for them is so strong, and they pick it up. I think they pick it up in the way she looks at them, and the way she talks to them, and her loving manner in which she touches and deals with them. And she is as loving to a sick rooster as she would be to a donkey. And that seems to be communicated to them, I think, through her body language and her tone of voice and her emotiveness. And between that and the food, almost every animal on the farm, when they hear her chuck, gets very excited and happy. The little chorus of baas and moos and barking and bleats whenever Annie shows up, I know she's here. And what I learned from it, the way I approach it is, you know, food is life itself for these creatures. And if you bring them food, they're going to like you, and they're going to be calm, and they're going to trust you. So I make it a point whenever I go out, I have some food, but not all day, you know. I try to keep it in check. So they eat their food, they get their treat, and then we go our separate ways.
Yeah. Well, I don't like being called late for dinner.
But you don't bother, though.
You know, but, you know, I have a cat now who... I don't think he could give a hoot for a treat. He is so uncat-like in this regard. He just, you open up the door, you come in the house, he hops up on the sofa, and it's like, hi. He is like your Clem.
Right. He's the unusual. Well, you know, I have two cats now. I don't know if I told you. I have two barn cats.
Two of them now.
Okay. Mother. And I've gotten quite an education from them. I mean, they are not like dogs, for sure. And I went out on Christmas Day. A friend of mine told me that cats are just like people, only better. And so I went out to observe Mother, who's very affectionate. She always follows us around, goes for walks, hops in my lap. I've got to tell you this, I was quite taken aback by what I observed for several hours. I never saw any creature kill so many things so happily, with such enthusiasm and such exquisite detail. It was amazing. And gleefully, really. So I think if they're, I said to myself, my God, if they're just like us, I need to call the police. And then, you know, she would do that and then hop in my lap and purr.
Yeah.
And that was my real first exposure to the sort of wonderful, you know, dichotomy that is cats. They don't give it away. They show affection on their own terms. And they have this kind of murderous instinct right there.
Yeah. Well, my guy doesn't go out, but he will really tear into some toys that look like mice.
Right, a mouse.
Mice and birds. So
yeah.
He's a very happy guy.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
He's like a lab.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a big love muffin.
That's great.
What was the animal population at Bedlam Farm when you began?
There were none. The farm, like many family farms, had been... really used as a retirement home or a second home for years. I think the only people who made it work as a farm were the people who built it in the 1800s and me. And it was used for different things and different crops, but there were no animals here. And so I had to shore up the barns, put up new fences, really put an enormous amount of rebuilding of the barns to get it in shape, jig around with the water. And then I brought sheep and then donkeys and then two steers and a cow and recently two cats, goats, a rooster, and some chickens.
Yeah. One of the things I loved reading about the donkeys, ever since I was a kid, I have had this thing for donkeys, and I have never met one. But I was so pleased to hear you say, or to read you say, in many ways they are the soul of my farm.
They are extraordinary creatures. They are very, very intelligent. Huge shock to me. I think they're smart, smarter than dogs even. They read human behavior like you wouldn't believe. If you go outside with an agenda, as if you have a needle in your pocket or medicine, they're gone. Even if they can't see it, they just know what you're doing. And they can tell somehow from the way you carry yourself. When the vet comes, she has to call 30 minutes ahead so I can get them in the barn with some oats, because they know her truck from miles away and will take off. And they're very loving. If you sit out there, they'll come up and they'll nuzzle you and put their heads on your shoulder. And I really feel, of all my animals, they probably tap into my moods more intuitively than any other creatures, even the dogs. And the dogs are very good at that. I just think they're also just kind of deliciously wicked. They want everything that they don't have. And if they're in one place, they want to be in the other place. And if they're across the street, they want to be on this side of the street. And they're very, very, very devious at getting there. They undo latches. They open gates. They dismantle gates in some cases. I had these ropes, and they just unhook them. So it's a chess match, a battle of wits with them.
Yeah.
Because the only way you can get them to do anything is to make them think it's their idea.
They're like people, only better.
I think they're very, very spiritual. They, of course, have been around people like dogs for thousands of years, and they seem like dogs to have a great read on people and how to deal with them. And, of course, the animals in our world that do well are animals that can manipulate people. I mean, those are the animals that thrive. Dogs, cats, and some of the other livestock animals. Animals that don't, raccoons, most cows, moles, they don't do well. And so this is really the survival ticket for the animal world. People who get humans to like them and let them in their houses do fine, and animals that don't suffer.
Elvis is a pretty interesting character, though.
Elvis is quite an interesting character. He came to me for a dairy farmer who has been dairy farming for nearly half a century, and he told me one day that he had a problem. He said he had a 2,200-pound Swiss steer, at the time 2,200, he's now bigger, and he just couldn't send the steer to market. I said, why? He said, there's just something about him. He said, he doesn't want to get on that truck, and he knows me, and he follows me around, and he reacts to me, and I just can't send him on the truck. So I was thinking when he told the story, well, so why is he telling me this story?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I said, are you looking to give him away? And he said, no, I'm looking to sell him. And I said, but Peter, surely you don't think there's a fool big enough anywhere around here to buy this 2,400-pound monster, not send him to market, and feed him hay for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. So, of course, he's here, and I bought him for $500. And I love him. He's quite a character. He loves people. He loves me. He follows me around. I give him apples and donuts once in a while. I've trained him to stay. He is very, very sociable, very affable. I don't think there's a lot going on up there, but he definitely has a life. He was lonely, so we got another cow to keep him company, Luna, and one more, Harold, who was also needed to be saved off a farm. And I think the surprise to me about Elvis, he's a lot of fun. He likes to come lumbering over. You have to be careful to get out of the way because he can't stop sometimes. And he likes to sort of eat my hat as a snack and give me a big kiss on the top of my bald head. And I have to say, it's quite a sobering experience to be kissed by Elvis. He's quite a significant tongue and drools quite a bit. and we have this great relationship where, I go up in the morning sometimes with a cup of coffee and I sit there with him and we stare out at the valley. And, he's one of those animals that gives off the appearance of being a deep well. God knows what's really going on in there, but that's the aura he gives off.
What do your neighbors think of Bedlam Farm? The people who are putting livestock on trucks to go to market and raising grain and so on and so forth?
Well, I think that, first of all, they're very happy that it's a working farm again. So they like that. Love to see barns fixed up and animals brought back. That they like. And they're very, I mean, they're amused. They're very tolerant of my foibles and strangeness. They're very happy that the farm is up and running and is being preserved and is being used as a farm. Certainly there are enormous cultural, political, and economic differences between me and them. Their lives are much harder than mine is. The economic realities they face are brutal. But one of the nice things about them is they are so non-grudging about other people. I mean, they don't begrudge me what I'm doing at all. They always say to me, well, if you can make this farm work by writing stories about it, great for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a generosity and support among them that is very touching. I didn't expect to find it. They give me advice. They come by and bail me out when I'm in trouble. And the basic idea for them is, well, you know, good for you. If you make it work, it's great.
Writer John Katz is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. How do you go about training a steer to stay?
Well, part of it is you have to get them to pay attention to you, and that is, of course, once again, brings us back to food.
Mm.
The first 2 or 3 months he was here, I never went into the pasture without food in my hand. Either a fistful of hay, which he loves, or a donut, or an apple, or a potato. He likes to snack on potatoes. And I would go out and just hold him up, and he would come running to get them. Began associating me with good things and trusting me and paying attention to where I was. When he would come running, I would hold up my arm or a stick right in front of his nose, tap him on the nose, and say, stay. And he would screech to a halt and stop and stare at me. And then when he stayed a while, I would give him something to eat. So he got that. And he loves his jelly donuts, and he loves apples, so he's very responsive to that.
Yeah.
And he does stop. He does. He stays. And I'm not hesitant, you know. If he doesn't, I come up and swat him right on the nose. And he turns around and runs. He has no idea how big he is, of course. I mean, he has not a clue as to how this is size.
Yeah.
But he has a very gentle and affable nature. He loves people. He loves people to scratch his head and scratch his neck. He's always happy to say hello.
Yeah. How do you know you can add an animal? You know, because it's kind of a delicate balance there. You've only got so many resources, so much space, so much time.
Well, I have 110 acres, mm-hmm. and so I'm very careful. I think I'm, you know, pretty much at the outer limit to what I want. I don't feel like I have too many animals. I don't want to get there. I don't see the place as a rescue clinic, and I don't see the place as a veterinary clinic. So the animals here have to be healthy. They have to be social. They have to get along with other animals. They have to get along with people. And those are the criterion for being here. And I don't want any more animals that I can know well or that I can afford to care for well. So I think I'm very careful about, with 110 acres, I have really very few animals, really, for the property. The cows and all have 15 or 20 acres to graze on. There's only 3 of them. The donkeys and the sheep have their own pasture. And I have additional meadows and acres across the road. So I have plenty of land for everybody, and there's plenty of grass, plenty of hay. So it's really a goodly number right now. I think I'm right about at the maximum. I don't think I'd want many more animals or any more than I can really get to know well.
Yeah. You were wondering about that donkey, the fourth donkey. Could you do the fourth donkey? But, of course, you did. You are. I want to go back and talk about the donkeys again because, you know, here is something that I feel such a thing with these with this species. I don't know why.
Where did it come from?
I'm not sure. I was telling Harriet Williamson, our producer, this morning that when I was a girl, my great aunt came back from a trip to Ireland with a beautiful little wind-up toy that was a donkey, and I just fell in love with it. And that might have been it, but I don't know. That seems not enough to...
Well, I mean, they're very. It's interesting that you haven't seen one. You know, the idea of them, I think, they're in a lot of books and literature.
Maybe that's it too.
They also have a rich spiritual history. They're very involved in the Bible and the New Testament and the Old Testament, in religious histories as well.
So tell us about the littlest guy, the youngest of the bunch.
Well, I had three females, Jeanette, Lulu, and Fanny. I had no males, and nobody, to my knowledge, was pregnant. So I was a little surprised last year when I got a call from my friend Anthony. He said, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but there's a baby donkey in your pastor. And I said, that's ridiculous. I thought that was a joke. Since I don't have a male, and I didn't, nobody was pregnant, that really couldn't be a baby donkey. I drove home to the farm and pulled over, and there, of course, was a baby donkey. And so I went up to Jeanette, and I said, you know, you can tell me who's the father. What's going on? And we noticed she was a little broad in the beam. You know, the vet was on me a bit because she was a little wide. But I saw that unusual, really. And she's a good eater. So we traced this back. We launched an investigation, and we discovered that donkeys, of course, have a long gestation period. And Jeanette got herself pregnant right before she came to the farm 14 months earlier. And so I named the baby donkey Jesus in honor of his immaculate, at the time, seemingly immaculate conception. And then, of course, as we found out, that probably wasn't so immaculate, but I was going to give Jeanette and Jesus away, since nobody really needs four donkeys. The four are so inseparable and so attached to one another that I was uncomfortable doing that. You know, if the vet comes to treat one of the donkeys, all the other donkeys gather around so closely they all put their heads on the vet's shoulder, almost as if to warn them, be careful. And they won't leave the other donkey, even though they're afraid of the vet. And they're, you know, that kind of attachment is just very powerful. And in a way, I mean, I think it's the strongest attachments I see on the farm. I mean, more so than the dogs to one another, too.
Yeah. Well, you say if you see a donkey alone, there's something wrong.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So and you know, the four is really, I mean, the mantra here is, well, two is not that much harder than one, and three is not that much harder than two, and four is not that much harder than three.
Yeah.
So we make do.
How did you decide to take in, now we'll talk about the dogs, how did you decide to take in one of the border collies, the dog featured on the cover of Dog Days?
Izzy. A writer came to upstate New York and bought an old farm and spent a fortune fixing it up and never came back, just never returned to it. Turned the farm over to a caretaker, got sick and bought some other place and just never came back. He had bought two New Zealand border collies who we left on the farm and had a caretaker sort of cared for. And for a number of years, really 6 years, these dogs lived outside almost entirely in a fence. They ran the fence, and they never went to the vet, and they never went a building. And they were beautiful dogs. And when the farm went up for sale, the caretaker had read one of my books and called me, and he said, look, you have to get... We have this very beautiful border collie who's been running this fence for years, and he's actually run a trench 2 or 3 feet deep into the ground. And you have to get him out of here. And I said, well, you know, I have enough dogs, and I have enough animals, and blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, I went to look at him and took him home with the notion of training him and then rehoming him. And so we know how that turned out. Everyone but me seems to understand how this turns out. Every time I sort of tell myself, well, I'm really just going to get this dog. I'm just going to bring him home, and I'm just going to train him, and then I'm going to find a good home for him. And that was it. And everybody knew the minute they saw me on this dog that he was not going anywhere. And so he's here.
Yeah.
He's a remarkable dog. You know, I've written, as you know, Celeste, about the idea of the lifetime dog, about the dog or cat we get once at a point in our lives that marks that period of life. And I thought for a long time that we only got one lifetime dog. And now I see, of course, that we can have more than that. And Izzy is almost, we're inseparable. He follows me every place. He goes every place. And it's almost as if he appeared to kind of guide me to another place, another level.
Yeah. I think that's part of what you said earlier about what this book is about.
Well, I think it is. I mean, there's a lot of openings going on. You know, I have a good friend who's an animal shaman and a soul retriever and an animal communicator. And I'm very skeptical of that. And 3 or 4 years ago, I would have, you know, either laughed or just not even told you that story. But she's become a very good friend. She has a page on my website, actually. And she does journeys with animals and runs around. And nowadays, I think nothing of, calling her up and saying, hey, Leslie, you know, well, one of the donkeys seems unhappy. Can you do a journey? And she's great. I mean, she just sees things I don't see, and she has gifts that I don't have, which does not mean they're not true.
Hmm. Where do you begin with a border collie like Izzy, who's, you know, as you said, he's just been running back and forth along the fence, digging himself a nice deep trench, and that's the extent of his life until you come along.
Well, I mean, dogs like that can be, as many of you and your listeners know, can be quite a challenge. And, you know, they've been through things we don't quite understand and we don't know. And so true, we're training in blind in a way because we don't know exactly what's happened to them. Izzy was he's a gorgeous dog and very good with people, but he was very, very aroused and obviously and distractible and confused and very anxious, I would say. When I first got him, he just about took the house apart. He dismantled crates. He ate paneling off the walls. He had diarrhea all over the place. He just wreaked havoc like a tornado.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been through this before with some difficult border collies. I began this training regimen of calming training, putting him in crates for small periods of time so he wouldn't be so confused. He would feel safer. Went through these very ritualistic training, you know, training the same time every day, doing the calming obedience training, lie down, sit and stay, that calm dogs down when they're aroused. And all of a sudden one day it was like a light switch, you know, was turned on. He just got it. He just became my dog. And since then I have taken him every place. He's become a hospice volunteer. He goes in the car with me everywhere. And he doesn't cause me or anyone else's seconds trouble. And I don't know how to account for it really because he doesn't fit into my conventional theories about dogs and training them.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if he was, you know, as Leslie says, he was waiting to guide me to the next place. And you know, I sometimes think that's true.
Mm. He's on the cover, and he's a beauty. He's just staring out at us, and he is so calm here.
That's how he is throughout. He is very calm. Yesterday we went on a book tour. We went to three different bookstores, and he hops in and out of the car, goes in the bookstore, meets people, says hello, lies down and goes to sleep. As calm as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to account for it really, because he should be, by what we know about dogs, kind of a mess.
Yeah. At one point in the story about Izzy, you say he seemed like many working dogs that chase in circles all day, a bit mad. And then also in another dispatch from Dog Days, you say, are these dogs, meaning border collies, really bright, or do they just have amazing instincts? Is there a line between smart and nuts? So back up a ways and tell us about what happened to you, and how did you become so partial to this breed?
Well, I like working dogs because working dogs have been bred to do things with people, and I like to do things with dogs, whether it's walking or hiking or swimming or whatever. Of course, I didn't imagine at the time that I would end up with a farm. And on a farm, not only are border collies nice, but they're sometimes essential to have around. I mean, you know, Rose runs the farm and does things every day that would be almost impossible to be here without her. The breed is extraordinarily bright and enthusiastic, and you know, it takes a certain kind of person to like them. They're really not for everybody. When you get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom, they're just as excited as if you just led them out to a sheep pasture. You know, what are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing? And they just have that get-up-and-go enthusiasm that I love. Every time I head for the door, I have these three dogs right there, tails going, let's go, let's go, let's go. So that picks me up. It lifts me up. Plus, which I do all sorts of things with them. I have three of them that are each specialists in their own right. Rose is the working dog, and she runs the farm and moves the animals around and is the supervisor. Izzy is just my buddy. He hangs around with me. He goes every place I go, and he just wants to come along. And I have Emma, who's sort of a love bug, who was on the farm with Izzy but has a lot of health problems, and she just wants to sit on the sofa and sleep.
Mm.
And so they have different specialties, but they're all very, very bright, always up to do things, always love to go places, and very trainable. So I think it's probably a case of them fitting my personality, which is somewhat restless and inquisitive and stirring by nature. So I really love the fact that whatever I'm going to do, they think it's the most exciting thing in the world, whether it's walking into the kitchen or... Now, that can drive some people crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not for everybody because, you know, there are times definitely with a border collie where you want them basically to say, look, you know,
yeah,
we don't have anything to do. We're not going to have anything to do, so lie down and leave me alone, which a lab will do, but not a border collie.
Yeah. So you've got the labs for the other side of your personality, huh?
And I have the labs, two labs. They do come and go more than the border collies. A Pearl, a yellow lab, is actually with my daughter in Brooklyn right now. My daughter is writing a book of her own about baseball. And Pearl is sent down as her writing support dog because Pearl knows how to do this. And Clementine, the other lab, who I call in the book the Whore of Bedlam Farm, you know, because I spent so many times pulling her out of vehicles that she was trying to get into because there was food there. But you know, she spends time in Vermont hiking and with a physical therapist there who has lives near a lake and does a lot of hiking and outdoor stuff. That's what Clem needed to do. And, you know, for me, as you know, I feel if you have a dog and you can't give the dog everything it deserves and you know somebody who does, it's perfectly fine to share them. That's what I'm doing with Clementine.
Yeah. How's your daughter's book coming along?
It's coming along very well. We credit Pearl to it. You know, she's writing a book about New York baseball. And it's interesting. So she's living completely the opposite life that I'm living. She's living in a room in Brooklyn, and I'm on 110 acres. And she couldn't be happier if she was living, you know, in Paris. And it's nice. It's nice to see. And Pearl's having a blast down there with her because people in New York are starved for dogs like that. And so she has a line of people
yeah.
waiting to see her every day.
Yeah. And also your wife, Paula Spann, is a writer.
Yep. Poor Paula, as she's known throughout the country.
Poor Paula. Do the three of you get together occasionally at the farm?
We do. We get together on all holidays and whatever we can do it on weekends. And, you know, neither one of these wonderful women is as enamored of the farm as I am.
Hmm.
And Paul loves to be here, loves to visit it, but does really not want to live here yet. And, and you know, that's fine. You know, I always miss her when she's not here, and I wish she were here. But I also understand that Paula needs to do the work she loves, much as I do, and would not be happy being up here, Mrs. John Katz. She just wouldn't like it.
Mm.
And it would be trouble, I think.
Yeah.
I think so. She comes up, really, I would say, 60-70% of the year, and the rest of the time we have an apartment in New Jersey, and I go back there sometimes. So we see quite a bit of each other, and, you know, I think, really, if she were a man, I don't think anybody would even raise an eyebrow about it.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I whatever works. Yeah, it works. Tell us your daughter's name and when we should look for her book.
Her name is Emma Spann, and she's doing a book for Ballantyne, and it's going to be on New York baseball, the Mets and the Yankees. It's going to be out next spring.
Excellent. Let's talk with a listener now.
Okay.
Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I came in a little late on your program, but I am enjoying it. Can you tell me, I was fascinated by your comments about donkeys. And what do they, are they work animals for you? What do donkeys eat? And how did you determine that you needed donkeys?
Well, donkeys are actually quite good guard animals. And if you have sheep,
yeah.
they protect the sheep from coyotes and
uh-huh.
dogs and anything, really.
Oh, okay.
And they're very protective of anything in the pasture with them.
Oh, okay.
I can't say that I need four of them, to be honest.
Okay.
So I get them as really work animals. And they do a great job. I've never had a dog or a coyote come anywhere near the sheep.
Yeah. Interesting. And you're saying they're very affectionate and
they're
intelligent.
They love
well.
People. Very social. They're, like dogs, you know, they've been around people for thousands of years.
Uh-huh.
So they know people quite well. They eat hay and grass.
Mm-hmm.
They can just, you know, graze anywhere there's grass.
Yeah.
They like to eat brush and all kinds of stuff. They're quite hardy.
Yeah.
They can be outside in very cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
They like to be inside that much. And in the winter, I just give them second cut hay.
Yeah,
and they do very well. I mean, they eat a lot of things, and they're very healthy. They don't need a lot of care. They need to have their hooves trimmed.
Yeah,
but they're actually quite useful. But the animal they remind me the most of, oddly, is really dogs.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I appreciate your sharing your information with us.
It's a pleasure. Bye bye.
It's very interesting that they can live so long.
They live long. Yes.
Yeah.
They live 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
You actually have to make arrangements for them.
Yeah.
They're a big surprise to me, you know, and they're you know, the only useful thing they do, I think, is keep stray creatures away, but that's very useful in a farm.
Oh. This is the Afternoon Magazine. John Katz, our guest this afternoon here on the program. We've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We would be remiss if we didn't talk more about Rose. She's a border collie's border collie. Tell us about, you said earlier it's really important that the animals have to get along. Maybe you'd tell us a little bit about the arrival of Rupert.
Well, every spring there's a breeding ram who comes, and we lamb. Rose, who's 30, this little sprite at 37 pounds, she sits watching this ram who comes in strutting and full of testosterone and ready for trouble. And the lambs can be very, you have to watch them. They butt other animals. They butt me. They'll put their heads down and charge at things. And they can be pretty tough. So we have an annual rite where they come in, they start strutting around and pushing everybody around. And then I let Rose in. And Rose goes right up to the ram and attaches herself to his private parts until he screams and then runs into the center of the flock and hides. And after that, there's no trouble. And she's done this 4 years in a row now. She's a quite remarkable dog, and really working with her, I think, is the most remarkable thing in my life on the farm, because I see it as very much of a partnership. I never set foot outside without her, and she has never encountered a problem that she couldn't help me resolve. And she keeps order. She just has a map in her head of how the farm should run, and she enforces it. I got her when she was 6 months old, and our relationship was cemented by that memorable night when I first came here, and it was a howling blizzard was approaching, and all the animals on the farm walked right through the main gate and out into the road, into the woods. And I was amazed and somewhat in trepidation of calling my wife and telling her that all the animals we had just trucked up there had walked out, disappearing into a blizzard. So, and I wasn't sure what to do myself. So Rose was running around in circles barking. She was a little puppy. And she kind of said, "Send me in, Coach. Send me in." And so I did. And she went flying through the woods, and I came running down. Of course, now I realized I had lost the animals and Rose. But she had run down into the meadow and corralled them in a little bit of a culvert and was holding them there. And nobody was moving until I got there. And then she rounded them up, and we marched them all the way back. And that has sort of set the tone, you know. Basically, Rose, it just handled tasks like that very competently, very well, and helps me run the place. I mean, she would just not be possible to be here without her.
Yeah. Remarkable judgment she displays, although maybe perhaps except when it comes to eating things out there. On the...
Well, you know, the thing about border collies, I think, is amazing, and of course we project a lot of things onto dogs that we want to project. Everybody talks about how smart border collies are, and Rose is certainly that. But she also can do some astoundingly stupid things. I mean, she eats poison things and dead things, and she tries to herd snowplux ambulances and diesel engines. And she tries to herd weed whackers and lawnmowers. And I think to myself, God, you know, for a smart breed, that, you know, you'd never see a lab doing that. But it's just part of their, you know, they have enormous and finely tuned instincts. And lots of things can trigger it. But you know, there is a fine line between the instinct of an animal and the brains of an animal, and I think we sometimes get the two mixed up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we all would do well by reading your book, The New Work of Dogs.
Thank you.
And Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm. When is the HBO movie coming out based on a dog year?
The movie's coming out in the spring. It stars Jeff Bridges. I think because basically he looks like me. It's basically, no, just kidding. It was pretty bizarre last year. They had the movie crew running around. They had five border collies from Hollywood in my barns playing my border collies. And, you know, I think it's kind of a strange experience. I am not involved that much in the production of it. I'm going to see it in a few weeks, which is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it's just kind of strange to have somebody portraying your life. I mean, it just seems odd.
Yeah. There we'll wrap it up. John, thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
John Katz, he's the author most recently of Dog Days, Dispatches from Bedlam Farm. The book is published by Villard. You can visit John and the farm at www.bedlamfarm.com. Beautiful website, lots of wonderful photographs. www.bedlamfarm.com. It is 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers in Chicago as they finished on this Friday afternoon. Futures and the Board of Trade like this in the soft red winter pit down 3.75 at 6.16.25 for the settlement price. But for the September, they had a high price of 6.30.25 today, a low at 6.13.25. Once again, the soft red September contractor lead option at $6.16.25, down 3.75 for the day. December futures 6.45.25 on the high, the low at 28.5. Their settlement price off a penny and 3/4, down at 6.33.5 for the day. And the March futures, 6.47.25 the high, the low at 32. They settled 4 cents lower at 6.33.5. May contract, 6.27.5 the high. The low there at 6.13, that was also the settlement price, down 7 cents. And July futures in the wheat pit, $5.75 the high, the low at 5.63. Settlement price at 5.63.75. They were down 2.75 for the afternoon. From the corn pit, nearby contract, 3 cents lower, 3.27.5 for the September high, the low at 3.15.25, settlement price at 3.18.25, down 3. And your new crop December futures, harvest month, 3.42.75 on the high, the low at 30.5, a settlement price at 3.33.5, they were down 2.75 for the day. March contract, 3.58 the high, the low at 46.25, settlement price at $3.48.75, down 3 cents. And the May at 367.25 high, low at 357. Settlement price at 359.25, down 3 cents for the day. July contracts 377.25 the high, the low at 366.5, settled at 368.25, and they were down 4. Taking a look now at the September for next year, 2008, 382 the high, the low at 373. Settlement price at 375, down 4 cents. And December futures down 4 as well. 386 the settlement price, the high there at 94.5, the low at 384.5. From the oat pit, nearby September's were a penny and a half higher at 240, and December oats at 243.75 were up 1.5. Soy complex now, August beans, $8.68 the high, the low there at 8.43.25, and a settlement price at $8.50.25. They were down 5.75 on the afternoon. September's 8.77 the high, the low at 8.53. Settlement price at 8.59.5, down 5.25. And November beans, $8.93.75 the high, low at 8.69. Settlement price at 8.75.25. They were down 6.75 for the day for the nearby, or rather the new crop November beans for the day. January futures now 9.08 the high, the low at 8.84.75. January